versus, in the interest of three minor children, AJ, L, AKMH, and QD, JW. So we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
May it please the court. My name is Sue Tebow, and I represented the petitioner in this matter, the people, as the assistant county attorney for Clear Creek County. With me today at council's table is the guardian ad litem for the children, Ann Parmley. She won't be presenting argument, but will be helping me address any questions I get stuck on. This case is important because the lives of two young children continue to be on hold for over 3.5 years now. When they were removed from their mother's home in March of 2007, one of the children was only 1 year old. Our Colorado Children's Code required that these children be placed in a permanent home within 1 year of the date of their removal. We are here today to present argument on only one issue, whether the Court of Appeals applied the proper standard of review in reversing the trial court's decision to terminate mother's parental rights. The trial court found there was clear and convincing evidence supporting termination of mother's parental rights under CRS 19-3-6041C. Specifically, the trial court found that mother was unfit and unable to provide appropriate parenting to her children due to her continued involvement with CAW, her failure to fully address her mental health needs, and her failure to recognize and repair the harm that she had caused her children by her substance abuse, domestic violence, neglect, and physical abuse. When an appellate court reviews such factual findings, it must apply the clearly erroneous standard of review. The standard is set out in Colorado Rule of Civil Procedure 52, and it requires that findings of fact shall not be set aside unless clearly erroneous, and due regard shall be given the opportunity of the trial court to judge the credibility of the witnesses. While the Court of Appeals discussed this clearly erroneous standard of review and appeared to recognize it as the proper standard of review, it did not apply it in this case. The Court of Appeals properly cited authority for using the clearly erroneous standard, and we have no dispute with any of those authorities and completely agree with them. We cited those and others in our briefs.
So, in other words, you agree that the court used the right standard, and there's nothing wrong with the standard of review. You're merely arguing with the application of that standard, in your view, should lead to a different result.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
All right, there were two parts or two things that the Court of Appeals said as far as the standard of review, and one was the clearly erroneous piece that you have quoted. But in addition to that, the trial court also cited a couple of its cases in using the terminology. A factual finding is clearly erroneous when the court, after reviewing the entire evidence, is left with the firm and definite conviction that a mistake has been made.
That's correct.
You agree with that as part of the clearly erroneous standard as well?
I do, Your Honor.
It seems to me, and I guess I'd interested in any comment, that that part of it, of the clearly erroneous standard, is that's well established. That is, the Court of Appeals cited to none of our cases. In the underlying cases to which they cited, there were references to a couple of our cases, one in which we used that, we cited that to the United States Supreme Court in a footnote, another one in which a dissent of one of the justices also referenced that terminology. But I'm not aware of us actually applying that. Is that incorrect? Have we actually applied that?
That is pretty much the question we're addressing here today. And that is where we part from the Court of Appeals rationale, is in its interpretation of when a factual finding is clearly erroneous. They did cite that case. They correctly cited that case. That's from N. Ray Estate of Schlegel, that a factual finding is clearly erroneous when the court, after reviewing the entire evidence, is left with the firm and definite conviction that a mistake has been made. But in this case, the Court of Appeals bypassed those authorities and relied upon the clear and convincing evidence standard required of a trial court. It stated that proof by clear and convincing evidence is proof which persuades the fact finder that the contention's truth is highly probable, and it is also free from serious or substantial doubt. Then it goes on to hold that because we conclude that the proof is not free from serious or substantial doubt concerning mother's unfitness and thus did not clearly and convincingly support the trial court's findings, the judgment terminating mother's parental rights must be reversed. Here then, the Court of Appeals has stepped into the role of the fact finder and re-decided the evidence. But the Court of Appeals' explanation for its conclusion that the proof was not free from serious and or substantial doubt is flawed.
I don't know, it seems to me that the Court of Appeals, due to the length of time and the idea that she'd really got the monkey off her back with respect to the meth use, that she deserved the benefit of the time delay. What do you think about that? I mean, isn't this a little bit horseback sense that might work? I mean, this is a serious thing, terminating parental rights. It has constitutional implications.
Clearly. Clearly.
So?
But there was more, and I think the importance of these cases that involve multiple problems of domestic violence, substance abuse, of physical harm to the children, neglect of the children. These children, when they were taken into custody, had been so neglected. Their dental needs were just abhorrent to us. I mean, many, many extractions, multiple fillings for the children. They had not been well cared for and had been neglected for a long period of time. These children suffered harm. And that is the part that never was addressed in this treatment plan. Yes, the substance abuse may have been addressed appropriately, but that was really the only thing that was addressed.
It's really her choice of partner and the partner's non-ability to accept these children. That's really the heart of this case, isn't it?
It is certainly a big factor that she stayed with CAW, who would not participate in the treatment plan at all, refused to have anything to do with the Department of Human Services in Colorado, and is actually still has arrest warrant out for his failure to comply with his probation requirements for his domestic violence charges.
Should her rights, though, depend on his reaction?
Not totally, but certainly that's a factor. Certainly it was a factor taken into account by the trial court.
Let me back you up just a little bit. You know, the clearly erroneous standard is axiomatic in terms of application to findings of fact. It appears from your argument that you sort of regard the entire order from the juvenile court as findings of fact, including, some of the conclusions that are necessary in order to terminate. One of those being, for example, the parent is unfit. I guess my question is the parent is unfit, is that truly a factual finding, or is that a conclusion of law? And if a conclusion of law, is it nonetheless reviewed in the same manner as factual findings, that is clear, if supported by the evidence?
I believe it's a factual finding, and I believe that's...
Are there any conclusions of law at all involved in the juvenile court's termination order?
I think mostly they are factual-based conclusions, and it does turn on the evidence presented to the trial court. I started out just looking at page one of the opinion, where the Court of Appeals says that although early reports indicate that mother was working hard in late March 2007, the court entered an adjudication order modifying mother's treatment plan to require her to complete a six-month inpatient drug treatment program. This statement sort of sets the tone of this opinion and demonstrates the view that the will appear to be given to all of the evidence. It makes the trial court's order for inpatient drug treatment seem unwarranted. But the record does not contain any early reports that indicate that mother was working hard. In fact, the evidence showed that the trial court ordered inpatient treatment because mother had not complied with outpatient treatment. She had continued to use methamphetamines, and she had been deceptive and dishonest with the treatment team, and her drug and alcohol counselor had recommended it. The opinion goes on to cite only evidence favorable to mother and essentially ignores all of the evidence supporting the trial court's decision. You can't read the opinion without wondering how the county could have been so incompetent and how the trial court could have ordered termination given this summary of the evidence. The analysis cannot justify any serious or substantial doubt. It simply substitutes the Court of Appeals judgment for that of the trial court. Our briefs do go into a detailed analysis of where the Court of Appeals went wrong with the evidence, so I won't repeat that now, but I will point out some of the significant evidence completely overlooked by the Court of Appeals. And that was expert testimony provided by the caseworker, Terry James Banks, the director of the Kemp Child Protection Team, Dr. Carol Marfitt, a psychologist, and Jane Hoffman, a parent-child interactional specialist.
Since your time is limited, rather than sort of just repeating the factual arguments, I wonder if you could instead give me your opinion or your advice concerning, other than simply reversing the result of the Court of Appeals, what would you expect from an opinion from this court in terms of what value or use or guidance would it be in this arena? What are the points that should make that would be of some use other than as relates to this particular case?
Well, I think, Your Honor, this court should follow the U.S. Supreme Court in the United States versus United States Gypsum Company. I think it must be presumed that the trial court weighed all of the evidence presented and found the evidence supporting termination to be more credible and more persuasive than the evidence presented by mother and her substance abuse providers. And I think it is not necessary, and I think the court should make that clear, that it is not necessary that the trial court specifically go through and state negative findings about evidence that it heard but found less persuasive.
Now, to be clear, Gypsum is the case from which this standard that the findings are clearly erroneous if the reviewing court has the firm and definite conviction that a mistake is made. That's where that comes from, Ms. Gypsum. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. So this court has held many times that the credibility of the witnesses, the sufficiency, probative effect, and weight of the evidence, and the inferences and conclusions to be drawn therefrom are all within the province of the trial court, whose conclusions will not be disturbed on review unless so clearly erroneous as to find no support in the record. That's from this court's decision in CAK. And as this court found in CAK, which was also a dependency and neglect case with similar issues and similar types of evidence, there is ample support in the record for this court's decision as in that one, and the Court of Appeals opinion should be reversed. Thank you, Your Honors. I'll reserve 2 minutes for my rebuttal.
Good morning. I'm Judith Carlson, and I represent Mother in this case. I'll try to remember to refer to her as Mother. My law partner and husband is present at the council table, and Mother is present in the courtroom today. We understand that the standard for the review is not clear and convincing evidence, that the standard is whether a mistake has been made. And I will also point this court to its own decision in the interest of MSH, where, as the court stated, we have reviewed the record in its entirety and are satisfied that each of the trial court's findings is supported by clear and convincing evidence. Thus, in reviewing the validity of the court's termination order, we must only determine whether its findings conform to the requirements of Section 1936041C and whether these findings were supported by clear and convincing evidence. The court here, the appellate court, found that the trial court did not find all of the elements by clear and convincing evidence, and that they could not reasonably have found on some of the elements that there was clear and convincing evidence. Given some of the court's earlier questions to Ms. Tebow, I will point the court to the fact that the father in this case, and there was testimony on the record as to this, when he went to Montana, had engaged in couples therapy with the mother, had gone into treatment for his own alcohol and drug abuse, had attended anger management treatment, and that there had been no domestic violence between the couple since they had left Colorado.
And that's in evidence before the trial judge?
Yes.
All these facts?
Yes. And the therapists who were seeing them up in Montana had stated that they had no fear about him with the children, and that they would have no problem with him being involved in the children's lives. The mother and the father have been parenting another child together since they moved to Montana. And the testimony from both therapists in Montana and from the expert down here who examined the mother with that child, because she was not allowed to see the other children, but with the new child, all thought that she was a good mother. And the quote from the Montana therapist was, she was doing wonderfully with the youngest child.
Counsel, can I stop you there? I take it from your emphasis on the Montana evidence. Do you agree that the Court of Appeals seemed to put more weight, I guess, on the more recent evidence versus the older evidence? I mean, it specifically uses the term, there was some support for the trial court's decision with the older evidence, and then it goes on and looks at the newer evidence. I'm wondering what your position is on that kind of older, newer kind of evidence question.
Well, the case that the Court of Appeals was relying on stated that the newer evidence should be given more weight when considering whether or not the parent was fit at the time of the hearing and whether or not they could reasonably be expected to be able to parent within a reasonable time. And I think that was the main evidence of the Court of Appeals argument, was that there was not enough evidence shown that she could not become the parent that was necessary within a reasonable period of time, because in fact she was at that period of time parenting and doing a very good job of it. She had completed individual therapy and was continuing to get individual therapy. She had completed the alcohol program and was actually a leader, and still is a leader, in the NA program up in Montana. She conducts classes and such. She had gone through parenting classes and had done everything that was on her treatment plan except for paying foster care fees. And at that time, when she first got to Montana, she was pregnant and wasn't working. And then she had an infant and wasn't working, so she had no ability to be able to pay the foster care fees. But other than that, she did everything. The trial court relies very heavily and mentions several times that she was dishonest and deceitful with her Montana therapist. There is no evidence in the record for that. And as a matter of fact, all of the evidence says that she was not. She went in within her first week in Montana, went into this agency and said, I need help. She did not have a copy of her treatment plan at that point because they had mailed it to her and she had moved and didn't receive it. But she immediately gave the therapist the name of her caseworker in Clear Creek County and the caseworker's telephone number and said, contact this woman, she will tell you what I need to do. They then evaluated her and said she did not need inpatient treatment, which turned out to be right. She was in intensive outpatient treatment and has been clean and sober now for 3.5 years. So their judgment as to the necessity of inpatient treatment was correct. They do not do inpatient treatment in Montana if you are not currently using drugs, and at that time she was not.
Wilson, could I interrupt you 1 second and ask maybe a little broader question, going back to some of the earlier ones we asked? And let me phrase it this way. How would you express the relationship between the clearly erroneous standard we talk about with regard to the fact finder's determinations, as to which, you know, we say the fact finder gets to determine the weight and credibility, and we will accept those findings unless they're clearly erroneous. How would you express the relationship between that and the ultimate standard of review of clearly convincing evidence, whether the ultimate fact has been established or the ultimate test or standard has been established by clear and convincing evidence? And let me just, rather than leave it too abstract, let me ask you one specific thing, which this question I came to mind as a result of what you were saying in terms of reciting specific evidence. What is the role of the appellate court in deciding these things if in effect the evidence, the factual determinations that are made by the trial court should be taken as correct unless they fail to meet the clearly erroneous standard?
I think in this case that the appellate court used the correct standard when they said that there was no way that you could reasonably find some of the things that the trial court judge had found.
And was that because the trial court judge, they decided, relied on some evidence as that was clearly erroneous, as to some of his factual findings were clearly erroneous, so they threw them out, and that left not clear and convincing evidence? Or were they accepting all of his findings and finding even that did not rise to the level of clear and convincing? Or were they giving weight to things that he didn't discuss one way or the other and saying, given what we think the weight should have been for this evidence, then there's not clear and convincing evidence?
I actually think it was all three of those things. I think there were things that they found that were in the record that he just totally ignored, and that they were uncontroverted, such as the things that the father had done in order to meet his treatment plan. The fact that there had been no domestic violence between the couple for some years at that point. I think that those things they found should have been considered and were not. I think that secondly, the court looked at some of the things that he did find and saw that the record controverted that, and that you could not possibly find the things that he did. I think they gave great weight to the prospective part of the statute, where it says, can she become a good mother within a reasonable period of time? The witnesses that Ms. Tebow refers to, Dr. Marfut and Terry James Banks, saw this woman when she was still using meth, and she was a horrible mother. I mean, you're not going to get any argument from me about that. I mean, she tried within what she could do at the time, but she couldn't do a whole lot at the time. She was very, very addicted. But she was a different person once she went through all of this therapy, all of this rehab, and the court just didn't give any weight to that except offhanded remarks of, we think she did a good job of getting sober, but that's not enough.
And maybe part of this is a question of findings that we've sort of talked about, how specific the trial judge has to be. But let's suppose, with regard to some of that evidence you've discussed, he said, well, I don't really believe that expert knows what he's talking about as much as this other expert. So I'm going to weight his testimony or projections or interpretation about this person's ability to be rehabilitated or how they would behave in the future. I'm going to treat it as less credible. Is that something the trial judge can do? And is it interfering with that for the appellate court to decide that he gave an improper balance of weight?
I certainly think that the trial judge can do that. They can say, this expert's much more credible than that expert. But in this case, there was no one who had seen her in the prospective role. What was she doing now? There wasn't a single expert other than the caseworker. And the people who were treating her were basically given, they weren't even much referred to by the court's opinion. And the fact that she had made all of these changes in a very short period of time, and then he finds she can't change anymore and she's not going to be able to reasonably parent these children. And the other thing that I think is extremely important that the court found is that she was never allowed visitation after mid-2007. There was no way the court could make a determination that she couldn't parent these other two children when nobody ever saw her with the other two children. She repeatedly asked for visitation. She was willing to come down from Montana anytime that it could be set up. I tried. As soon as I got into the case, I filed a motion for her to be able to visit with the children, and it was continually denied. And I don't see how you can make any kind of a decision as to whether or not she's okay with these children if no one ever sees her with these children, and the only children that she's seen with, she does really well with.
So let me ask you, just following in that, to what extent, if at all, was the Court of Appeals saying, well, there is evidence to support the trial court's findings and conclusions, but when we look at the entire record and review all the evidence, we are nonetheless left with this firm and definite conviction that the trial court made a mistake?
I think that if this court had not somewhat softened the CAK opinion, where it says there's no evidence, you know, has to be no evidence on the record to support anything, I think almost any case, there's going to be some witness who gets on the stand who's going to give some evidence that a court would be able to find reason for termination. But in this case, the overwhelming bulk of what went on in this case, once she had had treatment, was just so overwhelmingly for her to be able to parent these children that I think the court was looking at the entirety and saying, this is wrong, this is a mistake, this is not just.
Chief Justice, may I ask a question here that may go over time? The guardian ad litem has submitted what I think is a fairly persuasive brief on behalf of the interests of the children. I would, since I think it may affect the way I vote on this case, I would like your response to the guardian ad litem's brief and their position that it's in the best interest of the child to uphold the trial court, and no mistake was made here in that regard.
Well, I think I've already argued, you know, that mistake has been made. I think that if we are looking for the best interest of a child, I spent 5 years as a family court judge. I could always find a better family for any child that ever came in front of me. And the best interest of that child might have been served for me placing the child somewhere else. But at this point, the state interfered early with these children and never allowed them to get to know their mother. Never allowed any kind of contact.
Excuse me, the question was, would you respond to the brief of the guardian ad litem? Could you focus on that, please?
I think if all that you're going to look at this point is the best interest of the children have been with the foster parent for quite a while. And I'm not unmindful of the fact that that enters into the decision. I don't know what else to say about that other than, you know, it's an injustice to the mother and it's an injustice to the children.
Your Honors, listening to Mother's argument, it's apparent that she feels the evidence presented at trial was more persuasive than the evidence presented by the county. Clearly, we disagree on the evidence and the facts. It was not an easy case. But that is exactly the point of this appeal. Appellate courts do not decide facts. The trial court heard all of the evidence presented by Mother and the county. He reviewed all of the documents submitted as evidence. He listened to the witnesses and asked questions to clarify their testimony. He listened to our objections and made rulings on admissibility. The trial court, as a fact finder, was in a better position to make judgments about the reliability of the evidence than the reviewing court acting solely on the basis of the written record.
Ms. Tebow, may I interrupt you right there about fact? Just because I wanted to come back to a question that Justice Martinez asked you about fitness, the ultimate determination here, and whether it was a matter of law or a matter of fact. The statute says the considerations that are to be taken into account in deciding fitness, but it's clearly a sort of a totality of circumstances test. They list a number of factors and couldn't possibly describe exactly how the balance, how much weight to be given to each, but these are the factors that come into determination. Don't we usually treat a totality of circumstances test as a matter of law or a mixed question of fact and law, which an appellate court has to review with some degree of substance on its own?
I think possibly it could be a mixed question of fact and law. I think in this case it is a question of fact. And I think the TD case, which talks about the totality of the circumstances and is the case that said that the court should place more weight on the more recent reports and evidence, plays into that. But that case does not say that the trial court is required to consider the most recent reports and evidence and weigh them more heavily if they're less credible. I think it all boils down to credibility, and that is the role of the trial court judge, not the appellate court.
Thank you. On behalf of the court, counsel for your arguments, case will stand.